line.
At the same time, he went looking for people, software developers and hardware engineers and network engineers to build the system, the operations people to run it, and the salespeople to explain it to Wall Street. He had no trouble attracting people who knew him, just the opposite. A shockingly large number of people he worked with at RBC apparently felt the urge to entrust him with their careers. Several dozen people had hinted that they'd like to join him and do whatever he was doing. He found himself in a series of bizarre conversations, in which he tried to explain why they were better off being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to work at a big Wall Street bank than taking a flyer on a new business that had neither a clear plan nor a penny of financing. Still, people followed. Alan Zhang, the Golden Goose himself, got fired for sending RBC's computer code to himself and instantly turned up at Brad's front door. Billy Zhao was made redundant after he automated a complicated task so well that the bank no longer needed his help to do it. He came on board, too. But Brad needed people who didn't know him and who knew things he did not know. He needed especially people with a deep understanding of high-frequency trading and stock exchanges. And the first person he found was Don Bullerman. What everyone noticed about Don Bullerman, even if they didn't quite put it this way, was how badly he wanted not to be surprised by his own life. On top of that, he'd grown up in the Bronx and carried with him a resistance to sentiment. He ripped the filters off cigarettes before he smoked them. He weighed 100 pounds more than he should and ignored entreaties from his colleagues to exercise or take care of himself. "I'm going to die young anyway," he'd say. His finer feelings he treated much the way he treated his body, with something approaching disdain. "Much is made of a kind heart," he said. "I'm more of a feed-yourself-or-die kind of guy." To eliminate the possibility of surprise required not that Don's life be especially unsurprising, but that he control his feelings about whatever surprise it produced. How much he wished to manage these emotions could be seen when they were at their least manageable. On September 11, 2001, Don worked at a small new electronic stock exchange on the 12th floor of 100 Broadway, 500 yards from the World Trade Center. He'd arrived at 7 that morning. Before the stock market opened, he heard a bump, which sounded as if it had come from upstairs. "What we thought is that it was guys moving heavy equipment," he said. 5 minutes later, it's snowing office memos. He and his colleagues went to the window and heard the news on the office TV about the plane hitting one of the towers. "I thought it was an attack right away," he said. And so he was less shocked than his colleagues by what happened next. They had a direct view of the Twin Towers, across the Trinity Church graveyard, over the top of the American Stock Exchange. The second plane hit. "I felt the heat on my face through the window. You open the barbecue and your face feels like it pulls back. That feeling," he said. They discussed whether the towers were tall enough to reach them if one fell over. Then the first tower fell. "That's when we ran for the staircase." By the time they got to the 6th floor, Don couldn't see his hands in front of his face. Once outside, in the blizzard, he headed east. He walked alone and matter-of-factly up 3rd Avenue and then across the bridge over the Harlem River to his apartment in the Bronx, 16 miles in all. What stuck out in his mind from the day was how, when he arrived in Harlem, some women were waiting outside their homes with fruit juice for him to drink. "That one caught in my throat," he said. He added quickly, "Actually, I feel like a bit of a pussy that it got to me that way." The attack and the ensuing market convulsions killed off the new electronic stock exchange that employed him. Don, who had thought that the business was probably going to die anyway, went back to NYU to finish his college degree, and then on to a career at the NASDAQ Stock Exchange. 7 years in, his job was to deal with everything that happened after a trade occurred, but his specific role was less important than his general understanding. Both Ronan and Schwall thought that Don Bollerman knew breathtakingly more about the inner workings of the stock exchanges than anyone they had ever met. He'd been privy to just about everything that happened inside NASDAQ and brought an understanding not just of what had gone wrong, but how it might be set right. What had gone wrong, in Don's view, wasn't all that surprising or complicated. It had to do with human nature and the power of incentives. The rise of high-frequency trading and its ability to gain an edge on the rest of the market had created an opportunity for new exchanges like BATS and Direct Edge. By giving HFT what it wanted, speed in relation to the rest of the market, complexity only HFT understood, and payment to brokers for their customers' orders so that HFT had something to trade against, the new stock exchanges had stolen market share from the old stock exchanges. Don couldn't speak for NYSE, but he had watched NASDAQ respond by giving HFT firms what they asked for, and then figuring out how to charge them for it. "It was almost like you couldn't do anything about it," he said. "We did all this speed, and I don't think we fully understood what it was being used for. We just thought the new rules caused people to have a new experience and then new wants and needs." NASDAQ had become a public company in 2005, a year after Don had joined it. It had earnings targets to hit, it was incentivized to make decisions, and to make changes in the nature of the exchange, with a focus on their short-term consequences. It's hard to be forward-thinking when the whole of corporate America is about the next quarter's earnings, said Don. It went from, "Is this good for the market?" to, "Is this bad for the market?" And then it slides to, "Can we get this through the SEC?" The demon in this part of the story is expediency. By late 2011, when Bollerman quit his job, I felt there was a lack of leadership. More than two-thirds of NASDAQ's revenues derived, one way or another, from high-frequency trading firms. Don wasn't shocked or even all that disturbed by what had happened, or if he was, he disguised his feelings. The facts of Wall Street life were inherently brutal in his view. There was nothing that he couldn't imagine someone on Wall Street doing. He was fully aware that the high-frequency traders were preying on investors, and that the exchanges and brokers were being paid to help them to do it. He refused to feel morally outraged or self-righteous about any of it. I would ask the question, on the savanna, are the hyenas and the vultures the bad guys? He said. We have a boom in carcasses on the savanna. So what? It's not their fault. The opportunity is there. To Don's way of thinking, you were never going to change human nature, though you might alter the environment in which it expressed itself. Or maybe that's just what Don wanted to believe. He's kind of like the mob guy who cries every now and then after a hit, said Brad, who thought that Don was exactly the sort of person he needed. Brad wasn't in the market for self-righteousness or for people who define themselves by their fine moral sentiment. Disillusion isn't a useful emotion, he said. I need soldiers. Don was a soldier. Their new exchange needed a name. They called it the Investors Exchange, which wound up being shortened to IEX. Its goal was not to exterminate the hyenas and the vultures, but more subtly, to eliminate the opportunity for the kill. To do that, they needed to figure out the ways that the financial ecosystem favored predators over their prey. Enter the Puzzle Masters. Back in 2008, when it had first occurred to Brad that the stock market had become a black box whose inner workings eluded ordinary human understanding, he'd gone looking for technologically gifted people who might help him open the box and understand its contents. He'd started with Rob Park. With less precision, he gathered others. One was a 20-year-old Stanford junior named Dan Eisen, whose resume Brad discovered in a pile at RBC. The line that leapt out at him was, "Winner of the Microsoft College Puzzle Challenge." Every year, Microsoft sponsored this one-day, 10-hour, national brain-twisting marathon. It attracted thousands of young math and computer science types. Eisen and three friends had competed in 2007 against 1,000 other teams and had won the whole thing. "It's kind of a mix of cryptography, ciphers, and Sudoku," explained Eisen. "The solution to each puzzle offered clues to the other puzzles. To be really good at it, a person needed not only technical skill, but exceptional pattern recognition. There's some element of mechanical work and some element of aha," said Eisen. Brad had given Eisen both a job and a nickname, the Puzzle Master, soon shortened by RBC's traders to Puzz. Puzz was one of the people who had helped him create Thor. Puzz's peculiar ability to solve puzzles was suddenly even more relevant. "Creating a new stock exchange is a bit like creating a casino. Its creator needs to ensure that the casino cannot in some way be exploitable by the patrons. Or, at worst, he needs to know exactly how his system might be exploited so that he might monitor the exploitation, as a casino monitors card counting at the blackjack tables." "You are designing a system," said Puzz, "and you don't want the system to be gameable." The trouble with the stock market, with all of the public and private exchanges, was that they were fantastically gameable and had been gamed, first by clever guys in small shops and then by prop traders at the big Wall Street banks. That was the problem, Puzz thought. From the point of view of the most sophisticated traders, the stock market wasn't a mechanism for channeling capital to productive enterprise, but a puzzle to be solved. "Investing shouldn't be about gaming a system," he said. "It should be about something else." The simplest way to design a stock exchange that could not be gamed was to hire the very people best able to game it and encourage them to take their best shots. Brad didn't know any other national puzzle champions, but Puzz did. The first person he mentioned was his former Stanford teammate, Francis Chung. Francis worked as a trader at a high-frequency trading firm, but didn't like his job. Brad invited him in for a job interview. Francis turned up and just sat there. Brad gazed across a table. The young man was round-faced and shy and sweet-natured, but essentially non-interactive. "Why are you good at solving puzzles?" Brad asked him. Francis thought about it a moment.
"I'm not sure how good I am," said Francis.
"You just won the National Puzzle-Solving Championship." Francis thought about that some more.
"Yeah, I guess," he said.
Brad had done a lot of these interviews with technologists whose skills he could not judge. He left it to Rob to figure out if they could actually write code. He just wanted to know what kind of people they were. "I'm just looking for the type of people who won't get along here," said Brad. "Typically, it's because the way they describe their experience and the things they say are very self-serving. I don't get enough credit for what I do, or I'm overlooked. It's all about me. They're obsessed with titles and other things that don't matter. I try to find out how they work with other people. If they don't know something, what do? I look for sponges, learners." With Francis, he had no idea. Every question elicited some choked reply. Desperate to get something, anything out of him, Brad finally asked, "All right, just tell me, what do you like to do?" Francis thought about it.
"I like to dance," he said.
Then he went completely silent. After Francis had left, Brad hunted down Puzz. "Are you sure this is the guy?" he asked. "Trust me," said Puzz. It took roughly 6 weeks for Francis to get comfortable enough to speak up. Once he did, he wouldn't shut up. It was Francis who would eventually take all the rules they created for the exchange and translate them into step-by-step instructions for a computer to follow. Francis alone had the entire logic of the new exchange in his head. Francis fought more than anyone for, as he put it, making the system so simple there is nothing to game. And it was Francis whom Bowlerman dubbed the spoiler, because every time the other guys thought they had figured something out, Francis would step in and show them some loophole in their logic. "The level to which the kid will worry a problem is what really separates him," said Don Bowlerman, without any prior concern for whose theory he's going to upset, including his own. The only problem with the Puzzle Masters was that neither of them had ever worked inside a stock exchange. Bowlerman brought in a guy from NASDAQ, Konstantin Sokolov, who had helped to build the exchange's matching engine. The Puzzle Masters needed a guide, and Konstantin was that guide, said Brad. Konstantin was also Russian, born and raised in a small town on the Volga River. He had a theory about why so many Russians had wound up inside high-frequency trading. The old Soviet educational system channeled people away from the humanities and into math and science. The old Soviet culture also left its former citizens oddly prepared for Wall Street in the early 21st century. The Soviet-controlled economy was horrible and complicated, but riddled with loopholes. Everything was scarce. Everything was also gettable if you knew how to get it. "We had this system for 70 years," said Konstantin. "People learned to work around the system. The more you cultivate a class of people who know how to work around the system, the more people you will have who know how to do it well. All of the Soviet Union for 70 years were people who were skilled at working around the system." The population was thus well suited to exploit megatrends in both computers and the United States financial markets. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, a lot of Russians fled to the United States without a lot of English. One way to make a living without having to converse with the locals was to program their computers. "I know people who never programmed computers, but when they get here, they say they are computer programmers," said Konstantin. A Russian also tended to be quicker than most to see holes built into the U.S. stock exchanges, even if those holes were unintentional, because he had been raised by parents, in turn raised by their own parents, to game a flawed system. The role of the Puzzle Masters was to ensure that the new stock exchange did not contain aspects of a puzzle, that it had no problem inside its gears that could be solved. To begin, they listed the features of the existing stock exchanges and picked them apart. Aspects of the existing stock exchanges obviously incentivized bad behavior. Rebates, for instance. The maker-taker system of fees and kickbacks used by all of the exchanges was simply a method for paying the big Wall Street banks to screw the investors whose interests they were meant to guard. The rebates were the bait in the high-frequency traders' flash traps. The moving parts of the traps were order types. Order types, like market and limit, exist so that the person who submits the order to buy or sell stock retains some control over his order after it has entered the marketplace. The market order is the first and simplest type. Say, for instance, an investor wishes to buy 100 shares of Procter & Gamble. When he submits his order, the market for the shares in P&G is, say, 80 to 80.02. If he submits a market order, he will pay the offering price, in this case $80.02 per share. But a market order comes with a risk that the market will move between the time the order is submitted and the time it reaches the market. The flash crash was a dramatic illustration of that risk. Investors who submitted market orders wound up paying $100,000 a share for P&G and selling those same shares for a penny apiece. To control the risk of a market order, a second order type was invented, the limit order. The buyer of P&G shares might say, for instance, I'll buy 100 shares with a limit of $80.03 a share. By doing so, he will ensure that he does not pay $100,000 a share, but this may lead to a missed opportunity. He may not buy the shares at all because he never gets the price he wanted. Another simple and long-used order type is good till canceled. The investor who says he wants to buy 100 shares of P&G at $80 a share, good till canceled, will never have to think about it again until he buys them or does not. These order types are an acknowledgement that the investor cannot be physically present on the exchange to micromanage his situation. Order types also exist, less obviously, so that the person who is buying or selling stock can embed, in a single, simple instruction, a lot of other smaller instructions. The old order types were simple and straightforward and mainly sensible. The new order types that accompanied the explosion of high-frequency trading were nothing like that, either in detail or spirit. When in the summer of 2012 the Puzzle Masters gathered with Brad and Don and Ronan and Rob and Schwal in a room to think about them, there were maybe 150 different order types. What purpose did each serve? How might each be used? The New York Stock Exchange had created an order type that ensured that the trader who used it would trade only if the order on the other side of his was smaller than his own order. The purpose seemed to be to prevent a high-frequency trader from buying a small number of shares from an investor who was about to crush the market with a huge sale. Direct Edge created an order type that, for even more complicated reasons, allowed the high-frequency trading firm to withdraw 50% of its order the instant someone tried to act on it. All of the exchanges offered something called a post-only order. A post-only order to buy 100 shares of Procter & Gamble at $80 a share says, I want to buy 100 shares of Procter & Gamble at $80 a share, but only if I am on the passive side of the trade, where I can collect a rebate from the exchange. As if that weren't squirrely enough, the post-only order type now had many even more dubious permutations. The hide-not-slide order, for instance. With a hide-not-slide order, a high-frequency trader, for who else could or would use such a thing, would say, for example, I want to buy 100 shares of P&G at a limit of $80.03 a share, post only, hide not slide. One of the joys of the Puzzle Masters was their ability to figure out what on earth that meant. The descriptions of single order types filed with the SEC often went on for 20 pages and were in themselves puzzles, written in a language barely resembling English, and seemingly designed to bewilder anyone who dared to read them. I considered myself a somewhat expert on market structure, said Brad, but I needed a puzzle master with me to fully understand what the fuck any of it means. A hide-not-slide order. It was just one of maybe 50 such problems the puzzle masters solved, worked as follows. The trader said he was willing to buy the shares at a price, $80.03, above the current offering price, $80.02, but only if he was on the passive side of the trade, where he would be paid a rebate. He did this not because he wanted to buy the shares. He did this in case an actual buyer of stock, a real investor channeling capital to productive enterprise, came along and bought all the shares offered at $80.02. The high-frequency trader's hide-not-slide order then established him as first in line to purchase P&G shares if a subsequent investor came into the market to sell those shares. This was the case even if the investor who had bought the shares at $80.02 expressed further demand for them at the higher price. A hide-not-slide order was a way for a high-frequency trader to cut in line ahead of the people who had created the line in the first place and take the kickbacks paid to whoever happened to be at the front of the line. The puzzle masters spent days working through the many order types. All of them had one thing in common. They were designed to create an edge for HFT at the expense of investors. We'd always ask, "What is the point of that order if you want to trade?" said Brad. Most of the order types were designed to not trade, or at least to discourage trading. With every rock we turned over, we found a disadvantage for the person who was actually there to trade. Their purpose was to hardwire into the exchange's brain the interests of high-frequency traders at the expense of everyone who wasn't a high-frequency trader. And the high-frequency traders wanted to obtain information as cheaply and risklessly as possible about the behavior and intentions of stock market investors. That is why, though they made only half of all the trades in the U.S. stock market, they submitted more than 99% of the orders. Their orders were a tool for divining information about ordinary investors. The puzzle masters showed me the length the exchanges were willing to go to satisfy a goal that wasn't theirs, said Brad. The puzzle masters might not have thought of it this way at first, but in trying to design their exchange so that investors who came to it would remain safe from high-frequency traders, they were also divining the ways in which high-frequency traders stalked their prey. As they worked through the order types, they created a taxonomy of predatory behavior in the stock market. Broadly speaking, it appeared as if there were three activities that led to a vast amount of grotesquely unfair trading. The first they called electronic front-running, seeing an investor trying to do something in one place and racing him to the next, what had happened to Brad when he traded at RBC. The second they called rebate arbitrage, using the new complexity to game the seizing of whatever kickbacks the exchange offered without actually providing the liquidity that the kickback was presumably meant to entice. The third, and probably by far the most widespread, they called slow market arbitrage. This occurred when a high-frequency trader was able to see the price of a stock change on one exchange and pick off orders sitting on other exchanges before the exchanges were able to react. Say, for instance, the market for P&G shares is 80 to 80.01, and buyers and sellers sit on both sides of all the exchanges. A big seller comes in on the NYSE and knocks the price down to 79.98 to 79.99. High-frequency traders buy on NYSE at $79.99 and sell on all the other exchanges at $80 before the market officially changes. This happened all day, every day, and generated more billions of dollars a year than the other strategies combined. All three predatory strategies depended on speed, and to speed the puzzle masters turned their attention once they were done with the order types. They were trying to create a safe place where every dollar stood the same chance. How to do that when a handful of people in the market would always be faster than everyone else? They couldn't very well prohibit high-frequency traders from trading on the exchange. An exchange needed to offer fair access to all broker-dealers. And anyway, it wasn't high-frequency trading in itself that was pernicious. It was its predations. It wasn't necessary to eliminate high-frequency traders. All that was needed was to eliminate the unfair advantages they had, gained by speed and complexity. Rob Park put it best. Let's say you know something before everyone else. You are in a privileged state. Eliminating the position of privilege is impossible. Some people always will get the information first. Some people will always get it last. You can't stop it. What you can control is how many moves they can make to monetize it. The obvious starting point was to prohibit high-frequency traders from doing what they had done on all the other exchanges, co-locating inside them and getting the information about whatever happened on those exchanges before everyone else. The value of the microseconds saved by proximity to the exchanges explained why the exchanges expanded, bizarrely, after the people inside them had vanished. You might have thought that, when the whole of the stock market moved from a floor that needed to accommodate thousands of human traders into a single black box, the building that housed the exchange might shrink. Think again. The old New York Stock Exchange building on the corner of Wall and Broad Streets was 46,000 square feet. The NYSE data center in Mahwah, which housed the exchange, was 400,000 square feet. Because the value of the space around the black box was so great, the exchanges expanded to enclose greater amounts of that space so they might sell it. IEX could function happily inside a space roughly the size of a playhouse. This prohibition helped, but it did not entirely solve the problem. High-frequency traders would always be faster at processing the information they acquired from any exchange, and they would always be faster than anyone else to exploit that information on other exchanges. This new exchange would be required both to execute trades on itself and to route to the other exchanges the orders it was unable to execute. The puzzle masters wanted to encourage big orders and larger size trades, so that honest investors with a lot of stock to sell might collide with honest investors who had a lot of stock to buy without the intercession of HFT. If some big pension fund came to IEX to buy 1 million shares of P&G and found only 100,000 for sale there, it would be exposed to some high-frequency trader figuring out that its demand for P&G shares was unsatisfied. The puzzle masters wanted to be sure that they could beat any HFT firm to the supply of P&G stock on the other exchanges. They entertained all sorts of ideas about how to solve the speed problem. "We had professors coming through here constantly," said Brad. For instance, one professor suggested a randomized delay. Every order submitted to the new stock exchange would be assigned, at random, some time lag before it entered the market. The market information some high-frequency trader obtained with his 100-share sell order, the sole intention of which was to uncover the existence of a big buyer, might thus move so slowly that it would prove of no use to him. An order would become like a lottery ticket, a matter of chance. The puzzle masters instantly spotted the problem. Any decent HFT firm would simply buy huge numbers of lottery tickets to increase its chances of being the 100-share sell order that collided with the massive buy order. "Someone will just flood the market with orders," said Francis. "You end up massively increasing quote traffic for every move." It was Brad who had the crude first idea. "Everyone is fighting to get in as close to the exchange as possible. Why not push them as far away as possible? Put ourselves at a distance, but don't let anyone else be there." In designing the exchange, they needed to consider what the regulators would tolerate. They couldn't just do whatever they wanted. Brad kept a close eye on what the regulators already had approved, and paid special attention when the New York Stock Exchange won the SEC's approval for the strange thing they had done in Mahwah. They'd built this 400,000-square-foot fortress in the middle of nowhere, and they planned to sell, to high-frequency traders, access to their matching engine. But the moment they announced their plans, high-frequency trading firms began to buy up land surrounding the fort, so that they might be near the NYSE matching engine without paying the NYSE for the privilege. In response, the NYSE somehow persuaded the SEC to let them make a rule for themselves. Any banks or brokers or HFT firms that did not buy expensive space inside the fort would be allowed to connect to the NYSE in one of two places, Newark, New Jersey, or Manhattan. The time required to move a signal from those places to MAWA undermined HFT strategies, and so the banks and brokers and HFT firms were all forced to buy space inside the fort from the NYSE. Brad thought, why not create the distance that undermines HFT's strategies without selling high-frequency traders the right to put their computers in the same building? There was a precedent. They'd let NYSE do it, Brad said. Unless the regulators said you must allow co-location, they'd have to let IEX forbid it. The idea was to establish the IEX computer that matched buyers and sellers, the matching engine, at some meaningful distance from the place traders connected to IEX, called the point of presence, and to require anyone who wanted to trade to connect to the exchange at that point of presence. If you placed every participant in the market far enough away from the exchange, you could eliminate most and maybe all of the advantages created by speed. Their matching engine, they already knew, would be located in Weehawken, New Jersey. They'd been offered cheap space in a data center. The only question was, where to put the point of presence? Let's put it in Nebraska, someone said. But they all knew it would be harder to get the already reluctant Wall Street banks to connect to their market if the banks had to send people to Omaha to do it. Actually, though, it wasn't necessary for anyone to move to Nebraska. The delay needed only to be long enough for IEX, once it had executed some part of a customer's buy order, to beat HFT in a race to any other shares available in the marketplace at the same price. That is, to prevent electronic front-running. It needed to be long enough also for IEX, each time a share price moved on any exchange, to process the change and to move the prices of any orders resting on it so that they didn't get picked off in the way, say, that Rich Gates had been picked off when he ran his tests to determine if he was being ripped off inside the dark pools run by the big Wall Street banks. That is, to prevent small market arbitrage. The necessary delay turned out to be 320 microseconds. That was the time it took them, in the worst case, to send a signal to the exchange farthest from them, the NYSE in MAWA. Just to be sure, they rounded it up to 350 microseconds. The new stock exchange also cut off the food source for all identifiable predators. Brad, when he was a trader, had been cheated because his orders had arrived first at BATS, where HFT guys had picked up his signal and raced him to the other exchanges. The fiber routes through New Jersey that Ronan hand-picked were chosen so that an order sent from IEX to the other exchanges arrived at them all at precisely the same time. He thus achieved with hardware what Thor had achieved with software. Rich Gates had gotten himself picked off in the Wall Street dark pools because the dark pools had not moved fast enough to reprice his offer. The slow movement of the dark pools' prices had made it possible for a high-frequency trader, or the Wall Street bank's own traders, to exploit the orders inside it legally. To prevent the same thing from happening on their new exchange, IEX needed to be extremely fast, much faster than any other exchange. At the same time that they were slowing down everyone who traded on their exchange, they were speeding themselves up. To see the prices on the other stock exchanges, IEX didn't use the SIP or some phony improvement on the SIP, but instead created their own private, HFT-like pictures of the entire stock market. Ronan had scoured New Jersey for paths from their computers in Weehawken to all the other exchanges. There turned out to be thousands of them. "We use the fastest subterranean routes," said Ronan. "All the fiber we used was created by HFT for HFT. 100% of it." The 350-microsecond delay worked like a head start in a foot race. It ensured that IEX would be faster to see and react to the wider market than even the fastest high-frequency trader, thus preventing investors' orders from being abused by changes in that market. In the bargain, it prevented high-frequency traders, who would inevitably try to put their computers nearer than everyone else's to IEX's in Weehawken, from submitting their orders onto IEX more quickly than everyone else. To create the 350-microsecond delay, they needed to keep the new exchange roughly 38 miles from the place the brokers were allowed to connect to the exchange. That was a problem. Having cut one very good deal to put the exchange in Weehawken, they were offered another, to establish the point of presence in a data center in Secaucus, New Jersey. The two data centers were less than 10 miles apart, and already populated by other stock exchanges and all the high-frequency traders. "We're going into the lion's den," said Ronan. A bright idea came from a new employee, James Cape, who had just joined them from an HFT firm. "Coil the fiber. Instead of running straight fiber between the two places, coil 38 miles of fiber and stick it in a compartment the size of a shoebox to simulate the effects of the distance." And that's what they did. The information flowing between IEX and all the players on it would thus go round and round in thousands of tiny circles inside the magic shoebox. From the high-frequency trader's point of view, it was as if they'd been banished to West Babylon, New York. Creating fairness was remarkably simple. They would not sell to any one trader or investor the right to put his computers next to the exchange or special access to data from the exchange. They would pay no kickbacks to brokers or banks that sent orders. Instead, they'd charge both sides of any trade the same amount, 9/100ths of a cent per share, known as 9 mils. They'd allow just 3 order types, market, limit, and midpoint peg, which meant that the investor's order rested in between the current bid and offer of any stock. If the shares of Procter & Gamble were quoted in the wider market at 80 to 80.02, you can buy at $80.02 or sell at $80. A midpoint peg order would trade only at $80.01. "It's kind of like the fair price," said Brad. Finally, to ensure that their own incentives remained as closely aligned as they could be with those of stock market investors, the new exchange did not allow anyone who could trade directly on it to own any piece of it. Its owners were all ordinary investors who needed first to hand their orders to brokers. The design of the new stock exchange was such that it would yield all sorts of new information about the inner workings of the U.S. stock market, and indeed the entire financial system. For instance, it did not ban but welcomed high-frequency traders who wished to trade on it. If high-frequency traders performed a valuable service in the financial markets, they should still do so, after their unfair advantages had been eliminated. Once the new stock exchange opened for business, IEX would be able to see how much of what HFT did was useful simply by watching what, if anything, high-frequency traders did on the new exchange, where predation was not possible. The Puzzle Master's only question was whether, in their design, they had accounted for every possible form of market predation. That was the one thing even they did not know, whether they had missed something. The hidden passages and trapdoors that riddled the exchanges enabled a handful of players to exploit everyone else. The latter didn't understand that the game had been designed precisely for the former. As Brad put it, it's like you run this casino, and you need to get players in to attract other players. You invite a few players in to start a game of Texas Hold'em by telling them that the deck doesn't have any jacks or queens in it, and that you won't tell the other people who came to play with them. How do you get people into the casino? You pay the brokers to bring them there. By the summer of 2013, the world's financial markets were designed to maximize the number of collisions between ordinary investors and high-frequency traders, at the expense of ordinary investors and for the benefit of high-frequency traders, exchanges, Wall Street banks, and online brokerage firms. Around those collisions, an entire ecosystem had arisen. Brad had heard many first-hand accounts about the nature of that ecosystem. One came from a man named Chris Nagy, who until 2012 had been responsible for selling the order flow for TD Ameritrade. Every year, people from banks and high-frequency trading firms would fly to Omaha, where TD Ameritrade was based, and negotiate with Nagy. Most of the deals tend to be handshake deals, Nagy said. You go out to a steak dinner. We'll pay you 2 cents a share. Everything is good. The negotiations were always done face-to-face because no one involved wanted to leave a paper trail. The payment for the order flow is as off the record as possible, said Nagy. They never have an email or even a phone call. You had to fly down to meet with us. For its part, TD Ameritrade was required to publish how much per share they were making from the practice, but not the total amounts, which were buried on its income statements on a line labeled Other Revenue. So you can see the income, but you can't see the deals. In his years selling order flow, Nagy noticed a couple of things, and he related them both to Brad and his team when he came to visit them to find out why he kept hearing about this strange new thing called IEX. The first was that the market complexity created by Reg NMS, the rapid growth in the number of stock markets and in high-frequency trading, raised the value of a stock market customer's order. It caused the value of our flow to triple, at least, Nagy said. The other thing he couldn't help but notice was that not all of the online brokers appreciated the value of what they were selling. TD Ameritrade was able to sell the right to execute its customers' orders to high-frequency trading firms for hundreds of millions a year. The bigger Charles Schwab, whose order flow was even more valuable than TD Ameritrade's, had sold its flow to UBS back in 2005 in an 8-year deal for only $285 million. UBS charged the high-frequency trading firm Citadel some undisclosed sum to execute Schwab's trades. Schwab left at least $1 billion on the table, Nagy said. A lot of the people selling their customers' orders, it seemed to Nagy, had no idea of the value of the information the orders contained. Even he was unsure. The only way to know would be to find out how much money high-frequency traders were making by trading against slow-footed individual investors. I've tried over the years to find out how much money was being made by high-frequency trading, Nagy said. The market makers are always reluctant to share their performance. What Nagy did know was that the simple retail stock market order was, from the point of view of high-frequency traders, easy kill. Whose order flow is the most valuable? He said. Yours and mine. We don't have black boxes. We don't have algos. Our quotes are late to the market, a full second behind. In 2008, Citadel bought a stake in the online broker E-Trade, which was floundering in the credit crisis. The deal stipulated that E-Trade route some percentage of its customers' orders to Citadel. At the same time, E-Trade created its own high-frequency trading division, eventually called G1 Execution Services, to exploit the value of those orders for itself. Citadel's founder and CEO, Kenneth Griffin, pitched a fit and called out E-Trade publicly for failing to execute its customers' orders properly. High-frequency traders sought to trade as often as possible with ordinary investors who had slower connections. They were able to do so because the investors themselves had only the faintest clue of what was happening to them, and also because the investors, even big sophisticated ones, had no ability to control their own orders. When, say, Fidelity Investments sent a big stock market order to Bank of America, Bank of America treated that order as its own and behaved as if it, not Fidelity, owned the information associated with that order. The same was true when an individual investor bought stock through an online broker. The moment he pressed the buy icon on his screen, the business was out of his hands, and the information about his intentions belonged, in effect, to E-Trade or TD Ameritrade or Schwab. But the role in this of the 9 big Wall Street banks that controlled 70% of all stock market orders was more complicated than the role played by TD Ameritrade. The Wall Street banks controlled not only the orders and the informational value of those orders, but dark pools in which those orders might be executed. The banks took different approaches to milking the value of their customers' orders. All of them tended to send the orders first to their own dark pools before routing them out to the wider market. Inside the dark pool, the bank could trade against the orders themselves, or they could sell special access to the dark pool to high-frequency traders. Either way, the value of the customer's orders was monetized by the big Wall Street bank for the big Wall Street bank. If the bank was unable to execute a stock market order in its own dark pool, the bank directed that order first to the exchange that paid the biggest kickback for it, when the kickback was simply the bait for some flash trap. If the puzzle masters were right, and the design of IEX eliminated the advantage of speed, IEX would reduce the value of investors' stock market orders to zero. If the orders couldn't be exploited on this new exchange, if the information they contained was worthless, who would pay for the right to execute them? The big Wall Street banks and online brokers charged by investors with routing stock market orders to IEX would surrender billions of dollars in revenues in the process. And that, as everyone involved understood, wouldn't happen without a fight. One afternoon during the summer of 2013, a few months before the exchange planned to open for business, Brad called a meeting to figure out how to make the big Wall Street banks feel watched. IEX had raised more capital and hired more people and moved to a bigger room on the 30th floor of 7 World Trade Center. There still was no separate place to meet, however, so they gathered in a corner of the big room where a whiteboard met a window that offered a spectacular view of the 9/11 memorial. Don leaned with his back against the window, along with Ronan, Schwal, and Rob Park, while Brad stood in front of the whiteboard and took a whiteboard marker out of a bin. The 20 or so other employees of IEX remained at their desks in the room, pretending that nothing was happening. Then Matt Trudeau appeared and joined in. Matt was the only person in the room who had ever opened a brand new stock exchange, and so he tended to be included in every business discussion. Oddly enough, among them, he was least by nature a businessman. He had entered college to major in painting, and then, deciding he lacked the talent to make it as a painter, and thinking he might make it as an academic, had moved into the anthropology department. He didn't become an anthropologist either. After college, he had found work adjusting auto insurance claims, a job he judged to be among the world's most soul-sucking. One day on a lunch break, he noticed a television switched on to CNBC and wondered, why are there two separate ticker tapes? He began to study the stock market. 5 years later, in the mid-2000s, he was opening new American-style stock exchanges in foreign countries for a company with the mystifying name ChiX Global. It was marketing gone awry, he said. We spent the first 15 minutes of every meeting trying to explain our name. He'd been one part businessman and one part missionary. He met with officials of various governments, wrote white papers, and sat on panels to extol the virtues of American financial markets. After opening ChiX Canada, he had advised firms trying to open stock exchanges in Singapore, Tokyo, Australia, Hong Kong, and London. Did I think I was doing God's work? He said later. No. But I did think market efficiency was something important for the economy. As he spread the American financial gospel, he couldn't help but notice a pattern. A new exchange would open, and nothing would happen on it, until the high-frequency traders showed up, stuck their computers beside the exchange's matching engine, and turned the exchange around. Then he began to hear things, that some of the HFT guys might be shady, that stock exchanges had glitches built into them that HFT could use to exploit ordinary investors. He couldn't point to specific wrongdoing, but he felt less and less easy about his role in the universe. In 2010, ChiX promoted him to a big new job, Global Head of Product. But before he took the job, he came across an internet post by Sal Arnuk and Joseph Saluzzi. The post showed, in fine detail, how data about investors' orders provided to high-frequency traders by two of the public exchanges, BATS and NASDAQ, helped HFT discern investors' trading intentions. Most investors, Arnuk and Saluzzi wrote, have no idea that the private trade information they are entrusting to the market centers is being made public by the exchanges. The exchanges are not making this clear to their clients, but instead are actively broadcasting the information to the HFTs in order to court their order flow. It was the first credible evidence of Bigfoot, said Matt. He dug around on his own and saw that the glitches at BATS and NASDAQ that queered the market for the benefit of HFT weren't flukes, but symptoms of a systemic problem, and that many other little market quirks were there that were potentially being exploited. He was then in an awkward position, that of a public spokesman for the new American-style stock market who doubted the integrity of that market. I'm at the point where I no longer feel I can authentically defend high-frequency trading, he said. I look at us exporting our business model to all these different countries, and I think it's like exporting a disease. He was 34 years old and married, with a one-year-old child. ChiX was paying him more than $400,000 a year, and yet, with no idea what he was going to do to earn a living, he up and quit. I don't want to say I'm an idealist, he said, but you have a limited amount of time on this planet. I don't want to be 20 years from now and thinking I haven't lived my life in a way I could be proud of. He kicked around for the better part of a year, before he thought to call Ronan, whom he'd met when Ronan came through to run cables for HFT inside his Canadian exchange. In October 2012, they met for coffee at the McDonald's near Liberty Plaza, and Ronan explained he had just left RBC to open a new stock exchange. My first reaction was, I feel so bad for the guy, said Matt. He's just destroyed his future. They're just doomed. Then afterwards, I asked myself, what causes a bunch of people making a million a year to quit? He came back in November and asked Ronan some more questions about this new exchange. In December, Brad hired him. Standing in front of the whiteboard, Brad now reviewed the problem at hand. It was unusual for an investor to direct his broker to send his order to one exchange, but that is